Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by SDR Pods. Learn how we can build you a fully equipped sales development team to execute on personalized, multi-channel prospecting and book you more meetings at predictablerevenue.com/SDR-pods.
Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart, and today I'm joined by Kyle Lacey from Lesson Lee. This is our third—
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thanks for showing up. I think this is a PR podcast first. This is the first time we've had somebody— we've had three people from a single company on the show. Actually, that's not true. We had three people from Outreach. So you're now tied for first with Outreach.
That's good company to keep.
Yeah. So a little bit about this episode, and the reason why you're hearing Colin's voice instead of Sarah's voice is Sarah's obviously taken over the podcast. She kicked me out, and so did the rest of the marketing team. They say, you don't know what you're talking about when it comes to sales development. I said, but I still like talking. So they let me jump in on some of the more unique ones. And so today's going to be a bit of a left turn. If you're looking for sales development content, this might not be the episode for you. But if you want to hear a conversation about, you know, Kyle's the CMO over at Lesson Lee. He's helped a bunch of early stage companies grow. He's based in Indy. We're going to talk a little bit about why. Yeah, we're going to talk about who BDRs report to. It's a bit of a contentious issue between Kyle and I. So we'll try and keep the knives, you know, away from each other, each other's throats. But, you know, there might be a little bit of conflict. So if that sounds interesting, stay tuned. But we are going to do a little bit of a dive into sort of where does growth come from at Lesson Lee. We're going to get a little bit, there's some interesting stuff that I want to pull out of Kyle. So that's what we're focusing on today. Kyle, I noticed that BDRs roll up under marketing. What the hell's going on?
Well, so we moved BDRs under marketing in 2018, so it's been a while now that they've been in the marketing org. I think the initial reason is because we wanted to unite top of funnel. We wanted to make sure that the demand team, the content teams, the brand and marketing strategy teams were talking with the BDRs and the teams that were doing the majority of the outreach. It also made sense to me that the inbound SDRs lived in the same team that was doing all of the CRO tests and running the website. And it just made more sense that it was an effort joined together at the tip of the spear instead of it being shared between two teams.
That makes sense. Interesting that you still call it marketing when you've got sales rolling up under there. I can't criticize too much because we do something very, very similar, but we have them all rolling up under revenue. Maybe we're a little bit more kumbaya about it. But we went a slightly different path. We got to a similar spot. We call it a different thing, but we have he started life as a sales manager and has evolved into like VP of revenue. And so,
yeah, and that's, you know what, I am fine with the revenue model because I think marketers should be comped and be measured off revenue. I do believe that marketers should be the revenue leaders, not necessarily sales. And what's interesting to me is that if you talk to VC firms, private equity boards, they always go to the sales leader as the revenue leader. Mm-hmm. And I get that because the AE, it depends on what your model, like product-led growth, I think is a completely different discussion, right? But sales-led growth makes sense because the AE is the one closing the deal. But if marketing's doing their job correctly, they should be sourcing the majority of those deals to begin with. So it, for all intents and purposes, we are a revenue-generating team. We're just called marketing.
That's fair. And I guess I think there's a clear differentiation between, you know, marketing's job is to get the individual to show up, you know, at least on the inbound side. You know, there's sales development, the outbound side, it's the sales development rep's job. And then the sales job is obviously pick up that baton from, okay, we've had either first conversation or we've generated some sort of interest. And I think that's the sort of specialization model that, you know, Aaron talked about in the original predictable revenue. It's interesting that sort of sales development kind of sits as that bridge between the two, right? I think, like, again, there's no right or wrong answer. Our argument for like revenue was like sales development really didn't, it's not necessarily marketing. We wanted them to have more of a I think if you draw the distinction, or at least here in Vancouver, it's very common for people to think marketing and to think brand and not necessarily demand gen. And so too easy, if you're suddenly they're sitting under marketing, they're like, okay, well, you know, maybe the expectations are a little bit different. Maybe the purpose of the role is a little bit different, right? And our SDRs, they still have a quota, still have goals, inbound, outbound. Inbound and outbound for us is always rolled up under the same team. It's always been under sales development itself. So
yeah, look, I walking into this job, I was very much a brand marketer, but guess what? You can't do really cool brand stuff unless you generate revenue, because then you're just going to be seen as a brand marketer. So we have the ability to do amazing direct mail, board games, golden llamas, our world-class events, like all the stuff that we do is because we are revenue driving marketing team. And the other thing to note is that a lot of my peers talk about the alignment between sales and marketing is broken. When BDRs are under marketing, it forces alignment. Like you have to be aligned. Like there's no, the entire model breaks if the marketing and sales leadership are not aligned. And that's, and that, it, you know, outside of revenue, man, that has been the number one positive of having BDRs live under marketing, is because it forces marketing and sales leadership to communicate on a weekly basis, which they should be doing anyway.
I mean, I wish I could disagree with you more, because I came into this all like prepped for a fight. I was hitting the speed bag earlier. I was like, I'm going to take this guy out. No, I totally agree. When we had our BDRs roll up under, our BDRs have always, or SDRs have always rolled up under sales. When we pulled marketing in under sales and made it revenue, or when we created the revenue spot and we brought the teams together, we noticed the exact same thing. Suddenly our SDRs are sitting in Salesforce and like, hey, what are we doing about these? Oh, I heard you guys are doing this webinar. I saw this. And then all of a sudden all these things, like people that showed up for webinars that previously nothing was really happening. I mean, they'd go in the automated drips, but our BDR at the time was like, hey, there's gold here. I want to use this. So all of a sudden we were getting a multiple more out of our marketing efforts because we had that sales development person sitting there.
So where it breaks down for me a little bit is that if you can find a revenue driven marketer that has brand experience, it's easier for a marketer to run revenue teams, but also not forget the importance of brands in the market, right? Because we're going to be in feature wars for the rest of our lives. It does not matter. Like you could have the best AEs on the face of the planet, and if your brand's a piece of crap, you will lose the market battle. You will lose it. It does not matter. So that's where it breaks down for me a little bit. The only problem with marketing running sales is that most marketers, okay, I'm not going to say most, some marketers don't think about revenue. They think about brand and, hey, we influenced X amount of pipe gen. Like we don't, Leslie marketing team does not talk about influence. If you're doing your job correctly as a marketer, you should influence 100% of all revenue and all expansion opportunity because you're doing your job correctly, right? So that's where it breaks down to where my fear of moving marketing under a sales leader is that the sales leader does not focus as much on the importance of brand. And that's when you start seeing cuts from design teams, cuts from content teams, cuts from experience oriented teams, because it's so scientific on the sales side.
Yeah, fair. I think this is such a tough one to ask because it's going to be so dependent on who the candidate is.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%.
And like, I see myself as growing up in sales, but I don't have a traditional, like I started off as an SDR, I did AE. I just jumped right into being an AE and like ground my way through it. And I never actually was a real sales leader, even though I've had the name of my title a couple of times. And so that's interesting. Yeah, I think.
But it's all based off of your direct reports. Like if I was a sales leader and I took over marketing, I would have a demand gen leader, I would have a brand leader, and I would give them the autonomy to make decisions based off of their skill set. Mm-hmm. Right. I haven't seen it that often. Usually when marketing rolls under revenue, it becomes a second class citizen to the sales team. Hmm. But you could argue that the opposite would happen on the marketing side, right? So I think it's all dependent on how you build a leadership team and how you resource people.
For sure. And I think like the stage zero of this is like even before product, even before brand or mark or demand gen or revenue, so much of this is influenced by the product market fit, the category that you're in.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's so many different versions of this. It's almost silly to argue it because everybody's different.
So maybe talk to me a little bit about, talk to me about what's working well in Lessonly. And, you know, obviously the BDRs are getting more out of it. I've interviewed a couple of your people and they were like super on brand, which was odd for salespeople. They were actually a little bit in love with the marketing team or the, you know, which is not, you know, of all the companies I've talked to, they were evangelists of your brand, as opposed to when I've encountered other sales leaders, they were sales leaders. So what's so obviously the structure is different, but it can't be just the structure.
No, a lot of people wax poetic on culture, but I do think that that is a huge component of the Lessonly success, in my opinion, is that the foundation was built with the first three employees on our mission, vision, and values, and those haven't changed. You know, when you have a mission statement that says we help people do better work so they can live better lives, like it's a softball hit. It's like that's unbelievable mission statement, and a lot of people, and we spend a lot of time building that culture within the people that we hire, right? And we have onboarding and training software. So yeah, we should be really good at onboarding and training people within the culture dynamic of Lessonly. And so we've seen that from 20 people all the way up to 250 people that has scaled. Outside of that, it goes back to alignment, man. We support sales as deeply as possible throughout the entire sales cycle. So we're not here's MQLs, good luck. It is, here's a demo, here's a first meeting, what else do you need? And when you're a team, and the same goes to a revenue team, it's probably very similar. When you're a team that's all going towards the same revenue number, everybody's gonna be bought in.
Yep.
And that's why we comp marketing on revenue.
That I think is the sort of, we buried the lead a little bit there, because that seems somewhat non-standard from my limited experience.
Yeah. Yep.
What brought you to that conclusion?
I mean, it made the most sense. We have a commercial segment, we have an enterprise segment. The commercial segment is based off of meetings and revenue creation, right? Because our sales cycles are within the quarter. The enterprise segment is based primarily off pipe gen. And then there's a revenue number. So it just made more sense that you would comp the team off of the direct source revenue that they were creating as a marketing team. Now our brand and strategy team, which is more events, field support, designers, web dev, like they're comped on all revenue. Mm. All bound is what we call it. So it includes expansion, because they're also doing a lot of customer support. But it all goes back to a monetary value, because that's what grows businesses. It's not that you launched an ebook and you got tons of MQLs and the SDRs only found three people that were interested out of 3,000. Mm-hmm. It's that you actually drove revenue.
That's interesting. And so I don't want to get too deep into attribution, because as coming from sales and then moving and then taking on our marketing team a number of years ago, that was the thing that was one of the most confusing elements was to try and figure out attribution. So there's first touch, last touch, all touches, and then you come up with a custom algorithm for like, how do you weight them? It sounds like what your brand marketing, or sorry, the brand and strategy people are working on, you said all bound or all touch. So it's,
talk
to me about that. How does that work?
So we have an attribution model in our commercial segment. We don't really use it because it's first touch and sales cycles are quick enough where it makes sense. Hmm. So we call it direct source. So whoever sourced the deal within a certain time frame gets credit for that. enterprise is a little different. And I wouldn't say we're at the point where we've fully figured it out, but we're still doing a direct source model, first touch model for pipe gen. So if it came inbound, if it came, you know, if an SDR booked the meeting or BDR booked the meeting, they get credit for that pipe gen. Mm-hmm. But closed one revenue, we're still like 2.5 years into an enterprise function. So we're still trying to figure out, but you don't want to get too tactical or too granular on an attribution model, especially with the 12-month sales cycles. It's like, who cares? Who cares? Because you're getting to the point where people are going to be arguing over like what $5,000 attribution should go to this $100,000 deal. And guess what? You closed it. Mm-hmm. Use an attribution model to understand the sales cycle so that you can get better. So you can shorten it. But I don't make budget decisions off of any attribution model. Now that might change in the future, but right now that's reality for us.
So if I'm sitting in the seat of, cause I think I understand if I'm a sales rep working in your organization, I understand my comp plan, right? It's either I'm booking meetings or I'm closing deals. If I'm on the demand gen side, I want to see that first touch attribution and a closed deal. If I'm sitting in the seat of somebody who's on your brand or strategy team, how do I see that direct connection to my paycheck?
So that would be like hitting our all revenue number, which includes churn, expansion, and net new. Now it's something that we definitely are talking about internally to say, all right, maybe we need to get deeper on pipeline attribution for events. Maybe we need to think about how the customer marketing team really influences expansion revenue and comp on that. But right now it's, hey, that team focuses so much on everybody, net new, onboarding, customer, community. It just makes sense that they'd be comped over making sure that we hit our all revenue number instead of just net new.
Mm-hmm. I follow you. As a, like, logically, I hear that and I'm like, yeah, that makes a ton of sense. If I'm sitting in the role, I feel like I would be a bit disconnected from, like, you know, it's you're doing something and then 3 months down the road, maybe it has an impact. Not trying to criticize your comp. I was just like,
no, I know. No, I know you're not. I think that because they're working on so many different things and a lot of, and we've been pretty deep in like building out career pathing recently. Mm-hmm. A lot of the bonuses and like career progression happens on the project level. So if you're a designer, did you get the project done on time? Like, did you do it to the best of your ability? Did you exceed your abilities to get it done? So there's a component of that where they might get bonused off of things, but the variable percentage of overall OTE, their overall comp model is fairly small compared to like a sales, like an AE.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's funny. Our finance team, they look at me, they're like, you can absolutely tell that this company is run by somebody who came from sales when you look at all the base variable combinations. And I think I'd say of the 60 or 70 people we have in PR, almost everybody has some form of variable.
Yeah, we do too. And we've got, you know, that's either a percentage of total base or they're on some like milestone plan. But that's spread, like we're at 250. So that, and it's very similar. Everybody kind of has a variable model depending on where they live in the company.
Right on. And so with those three teams, so there's the brand and strategy, there's the sort of demand gen team, and then there's your obviously BDR team and then closing team. What does your, like, yeah, let's talk about your go-to-market for a second in terms of, you know, it sounds like there's a commercial and enterprise motion. I'm curious, you know, how do you think about commercial versus enterprise? I think I heard sort of meetings versus pipe gen. Maybe to tell me a little bit about that.
So for commercial, it's heavier on inbound when we're talking about direct source. So you got a combination of inbound, which includes content, organic, Google Ads, all that stuff, right? And then you've got commercial BDRs that source X amount of revenue. Mm-hmm. And then you've got AEs are tasked to self-source a percentage of their quota. So the way it kind of breaks down is, for lack of argument, it's 50, 30, 20. 50% is generated by the marketing team, 30% is generated by the outbound team, and the rest is generated by the AE on the commercial side. Now that, you know, what we're seeing is that AEs are getting even better at self-sourcing. So that's offsetting, like, inbound. We adjust it every quarter and we try to keep ahead of it where, hey, in Q3, AEs are going to self-source 30 and inbound's only going to have to do 40. You know, we adjust the model. Enterprise, the majority of pipe gen is coming from BDRs. So I'd say, I mean, it fluctuates, man, but we're pretty good at driving enterprise deals via inbound. So I'd say it's probably 60-40. 60% of pipe is generated by outbound BDRs, 40% is generated by inbound.
Right on.
And enterprise AEs are not necessarily tasked to self-source. It's really the BDR that's meant to help them do that.
Just to help me understand the motion, is there a dollar amount that separates commercial and enterprise?
It's an employee count. So really, for inbound, it's 2,500 employees. Mm-hmm. For outbound, we're looking at like 10,000 plus employees as enterprise. But our commercial segment is 100 to 2,500.
Really cool. And then sounds like a much shorter sales cycle on the commercial side. If I guessed around $20,000 and a month long sales cycle, month to 6 week sales cycle, am I roughly in the ballpark?
Yeah.
And then on the enterprise, it's probably, I'm guessing, six figures. I heard 6 to 12 months, which could be 6 to 18 months.
Which could be, it depends on the deal size. And at enterprise, because it's newer, it's not brand new, but the go-to-market's newer, we're still trying to figure out the best way to do that.
Yeah, that's fair. Interesting. Okay. Very cool. It just reminded me of a conversation I had with Jamie Buss. She's the VP of Sales North America at Zendesk. And they're at a much different scale, but they had two different motions. And she had one where it was like, she's got a spreadsheet and she's got formulas for forecasting. And the other was getting deep into MedPick and forecasting in terms of like having all of her managers do this pipe review. And then she had a bit of a, like, there was a process. It's super interesting.
So we use a company called Canopy to do all of that forecasting and modeling. And then we have weekly funnel and pipeline meetings with all the revenue leaders so that everybody's tasked appropriately. But it's the breakdowns are pretty similar. It's just the ratio, like we do 1-to-1 BDR to AE ratio in enterprise. Mm-hmm. In our commercial segment, we have two tiers. Our tier one AEs are larger geos, larger metros. And they have a BDR 1-to-1 ratio. And then we have other AEs, the tier two, that is kind of 3-to-1 ratio, 3 AEs for every 1 BDR.
Gotcha. And that's still on the enterprise side?
No, that's commercial.
That's commercial side.
So enterprise is 1-to-1.
Okay, cool. Awesome. And so if we look at, say, commercial side, you got 50, 30, 20. So 50% is coming from marketing, 30 coming from BDRs, 20 coming from self-source. And then on the enterprise side, basically it's 40% inbound. And then there's a fairly large chunk coming from the inbound side of things. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about where that deal flow is coming from. Like I think I heard you say
it's organic.
Really?
It's organic mostly I think it's organic. We have a random come in through like Capterra or Software Advice, any of the reviews that everybody that's owned by Gartner basically. But I'd say a large portion of it's organic. Hmm.
So talk to me about that. So this is SEO paying off. Are there specific things that you're doing that's
We have one full-time person that only focuses on organic. We use a company called Demandwell, which is a organic software provider that helps us with managing all of our keywords, all of our content production. We have a ton of contract writers that help us with pillar pages and all the other, like that is about as much as I know. Outside of that, it's focused on what page ones do we need to support? What future keywords are we going to want to rank for based off of our product roadmap? And it is a huge revenue driver for us. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that it is, and I can't get too deep in the tactical side of it because I'm not as familiar, but when I joined Lessonly, organic was 40% of all of our inbound. As we've added on millions and millions and millions of dollars in ARR, it's still about 40%. So it's pretty crazy to view that because the revenue has significantly increased, but the share of organic has increased with it.
That's really interesting. I remember talking to when Aaron updated his last book, Impossible to Inevitable. We did the next version a year or two ago, and I had a chance to sit down with John Miller, who founded mm-hmm. Marketo and then Engageo. And I remember he was talking about the reaching a point in Marketo's life, and he thought it was around the $10 or $20 million mark, but he couldn't remember exactly at that point. He said he just hit this point where he realized just writing another ebook wasn't going to help him hit their growth targets. And it sounded like there was a bit of a wall, and suddenly sort of there was this natural cap on inbound marketing for them. And that if they wanted to sort of accelerate beyond that, they had to add all these other things. It doesn't sound like there was as much of a cap though. If it's still 40% and you've done a significant amount of growth, it seems like it scaled pretty well. I'm guessing beyond the $10 or $20 million mark.
Yeah, it is scaling. It is scaling well. I am waiting for that ceiling. Mm-hmm. For sure. I think it happens. And we've started differentiating with like spending more on analyst firms and benchmarking data, like more of the deliverables that will drive enterprise type business. Mm-hmm. But I know the ceiling's coming because I trust John and I know that he is correct. So the most important part is making sure that the demand gen model is not fragile, right? And that you're not relying on one core channel to drive the majority of your inbound. And that it needs to be anti-fragile. You need to have multiple channels that are driving it. So is that partnerships? Is it channel? Is it, there's tons of, you know, do you get AEs to self-source more? So, and then, you know, I think segments, verticals, all that stuff comes into question and conversations when you're trying to talk about strategy. Do you expand into international? Mm-hmm. Right, there's just tons of different ways that you could go about it, which is what makes all this stuff so exciting, of course, which is why we all do this, because it's like a puzzle. Every day is a puzzle.
I mean I've sat not really in the CMO seat, but I've led marketing, but I wouldn't claim to be I'm not even sure I'd describe myself as a marketing leader, even though I did lead the marketing team. And I feel the same way about sales, even though I did lead our sales team. It kind of brings us to an interesting point in the interview where I was trying to look for like, what is, if you were a superhero, what would be your superpower, right? And it sounds like playing maybe I'm describing it wrong, but I heard somebody explain it to me this way a long time ago and it really stuck, is they're just playing a channel arbitrage game, right? You try and find the channel that's the new hotness so you can get in there early and get maximum results off. And then that's going to taper as more people adopt that channel.
I don't think we do that. I think that we go to the mature channels to double down on what's working. Like we started talking about Reddit internally recently. Mm-hmm. That's not like we were on Clubhouse trying to do like podcasting on Clubhouse, right? Like it's just not something that we spend a lot of time trying to figure out. And I don't know whether that's good or bad, because it's not something that I personally, like I didn't jump on Clubhouse. We could talk about that forever, but for me, it is continuous rapid improvement. Like how do you test constantly? So you're constantly evolving And I don't care if that's on Clubhouse or it's on Reddit. All I care about is that you're evolving your strategy on a biweekly basis.
So really interesting piece. Tell me more about how you're like, are you evaluating new channels every couple of weeks then? Or how do you run those experiments?
Well, so we have a CRO team, a click rate optimization team that runs biweekly experiments. So it could be as big as, hey, we're going to try a new drift bot, to as small as we want the button on this one page to move when you mouse over it. So there are cases where somebody will bring to the CRO table, hey, I'd like to test a campaign on Reddit. Or I think we need to spend more on this Forrester report doing advertising via LinkedIn. So we're not saying, hey, every other week you need to bring a new channel to test. Mm-hmm. It's more just what do we think could work, and let's test it to see before we put a ton of time and energy into it.
How do you test something? Like, let's pretend you weren't doing SEO, which we know is a huge chunk right now. Yeah. SEO, it doesn't seem to me like something that could be tested in a 2-week cycle. So there are other things that might be similar to SEO. How do you think about bringing those in? Because I've made the big push, and our marketing team is probably, well, at least one person's going to listen to it from the marketing team because they have to edit it and push it up. And they know I've pushed hard on YouTube because I think it's the second largest search engine in the world. But we haven't created, we tested streaming. We've tested, creating some unique videos for it. But it's one of those long game things that as soon as the algorithm decides you're good, you've got to put a significant amount of work into it. And so how do you reconcile that with, we want to be testing on a weekly basis?
I don't think we do it very well. I would say that if we were going to test longer term, it would be a 6-month type test. Mm-hmm. But it's been rare that we've done that. I mean, for something, it's a good question. I mean, I think that we iterate pretty well, but from a long-term perspective, we could do better at it for sure. And that's really on me. Any CMO or CRO should be looking 12 to 18 months ahead, right? Mm-hmm. But from the past 4.5 years of growing this company, it's been the traditional stuff that we should have done. The analyst relations, the product marketing stuff. Like, it's been the in your face, people have been doing it for a decade that we should have picked up, not some growth hack.
Yeah. And that's fair. I probably had,
and not that YouTube's a growth hack. It's the second largest, what you said, it's clearly not a growth hack, but it just hasn't been what I would read from growth hacking experts or however they want to call themselves now, usually is not the ones that we're implementing that are working. Hmm.
So what are those basics? Because no judgment here. I've been the opposite, and it's probably, it hasn't served our marketing team well, where I've been pushing them to be long on things, but yeah, long on things that are maybe a little bit more fringe, where I probably should have just said, hey, we're not doing the, like, our basic ABCs. Why don't we focus on that first before going long on something like YouTube?
Yeah, I think, and this should all be taken with a grain of salt for those of you listening and watching, because it's very different for every single company. But for us, it is organic search, it's content marketing, it's ad campaigns, social and paid, so Google, Bing, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and then you have the subsets of those, Instagram, YouTube, all that stuff, right? And then you have a, like, air cover model, which is more of like the ABM approach, which is still kind of out there, right? Where you're trying to support outbound strategy. You're mm-hmm. trying to support outbound strategy. And then you've got analyst relations, product marketing, and PR. And, we, there are definitely failures that I've had over the past 4.5 years, and most of them have been traditional. And we do a lot of direct mail too, but that's because we've been doing that forever.
Interesting. I'm curious about the direct mail. I'm also curious about the product marketing piece. So why don't we start with direct mail? What do you guys, are you sending out calendars, phone books? Are you sending out the Netflix boxes?
We should do calendars. So we use Postal, which is a direct mail, you know, software. And I mean, they're way more than that, but it's a lot of deal support. It's not really net new. So AEs are on Postal. They can send all the different stuff, our swag, our golden llamas, our books, like all that stuff. So direct mail is more deal support. And we also use it just for brand. Like we launched a clothing company called Ollie Llama & Co. that is on a Shopify store and has nothing to do with Lessonly. It's just a clothing brand that we launched for a brand play. And that type of stuff, you know, when you can give gift cards to prospects to say, hey, go pick out some cool t-shirt or sweatshirt that doesn't have the Lessonly name on it, like that's different than me getting another stupid Yeti. Like, I don't need another Yeti. That's a very first world problem for me to state, but I don't need another t-shirt. I don't need another cup. I don't need another coffee cup. Quit sending me stocking caps and coffee cups. Mm-hmm. So how can you make it a little bit different? I mean, that's how we think about it from a direct mail standpoint.
Not that I'm going to go and buy something on Spotify or on Shopify right now. Shopify has an office. They're a Canadian company. They have an office here. My friend works there. Every time I talk to Calv, I always call it Spotify. I'm like, so how are things with Spotify? Both logos are green. They're both circles. I get it wrong all the time.
They're very similar.
So I know we're not talking about music. You got a Shopify store. You said Dalai Llama? What is it?
Ollie. So Ollie. So our mascot is a llama. This is Ollie. If you're watching this, it's on my t-shirt. So OllieLlama.co is our Shopify store that has shirts, sweatshirts, sweatpants, pants, rain jackets, earrings, just a ton of stuff on it.
Nice. That's A-L-I-A-L-L-I-I-E.
O-L-L-I-E.
Ollie. There we go.
OllieLlama.co. OllieLlama.co.
Let's just make it the most impossibly hard domain to spell.
I don't know who spells Ollie, O-L-Y. Ollie's usually like O-L-L-I-E, right?
I was thinking like Muhammad Ali, like Ali, A-L-I.
Oh, Ollie.
No,
it's my Indiana accent that's throwing you off.
Yeah. It's so close to Canadian. It's so similar. That's my excuse. That's awesome. So you got your own little Shopify store, so you can jump in there and it's not branded, but you can get a decent looking hoodie and they'll know who it is. It is cool little golden llamas. Dude, this is great.
Yeah. So it's fun for our creative teams to come up with this stuff. We use it for our holiday gifts. Like, we sent all of our customers gift cards for it.
Nice.
So they could either choose to donate it to our foundation or go pick up a hoodie if they wanted it. And it's a different way. It's a way to differentiate yourself, right?
That's really neat, actually. And do you have, obviously, I guess Shopify doesn't have the delivery services or the production services. So you got a company behind that.
Yeah. So it's a company called Screenbroidery, and we do a lot of this stuff on demand. So they do all the fulfillment.
Very cool. Awesome. That was a bit of a tangent, but super cool idea to have the Shopify store. So we were talking about, so a little bit on the marketing side, the direct mail side. So you're sending, you're sending gift cards to Ollie Llama?
Ollie Llama & Co. There's gift cards. Like, we use the Postal, the company gives you access to a ton of different gift cards. And so AEs and BDRs have monthly budgets to spend. And Postal has a system where you can just send a landing page to a prospect and have them enter in their address. So we don't actually get the address. So it saves like some privacy issues. And, And we run all of our virtual events through Postal as well, like wine tasting and whiskey tasting and cooking classes and all that stuff.
Oh, very cool. Love it. That's postal.io in case you're trying to Google it and you can't find it.
Yeah, postal.io. They're definitely easier than hollylama.co.
Well, now it sounds like you called her Holly Llama with an H.
I've been talking all day and I'm from Indiana, so we tend to draw our words out eventually.
That's fair. My name's Colin Stewart and I have to spell it because there's multiple ways of spelling both. It's always been the hardest email to have. And then previous companies, then if you've got a hard domain to spell as well, it's like, oh man.
I wish I had a harder name to spell for sure, but that's Kyle's pretty easy for people.
Yeah. So the last piece, and I know you got a hard stop. And so I want to get to the product management piece the product marketing element. This is such a, in my books, such a key piece that I feel like a lot of companies miss. I'm curious what your product marketing motion looks like, how it supports the team.
So you're going to love this because Leslie does not build teams in any way that like anybody else. Our product marketing team lives in what we call revenue effectiveness. And revenue effectiveness, it lives in the middle of marketing, sales, and CX and services. So all of the revenue generating teams, and they consist of solutions consultants, sales enablement. So we have a marketing enablement person, we have a sales enablement person, we have a CX enablement person, we have an onboarding enablement. And then product marketing lives in that org as well. So it's like it's the hub of the revenue team, and the revenue effectiveness team reports into the sales org. So, from a dotted line perspective, we talk to the product marketing team all day, every day, but they really report into the sales org.
I think you have somebody over there that just enjoys drawing org charts.
It's probably me. If you were to ask me, well, you could ask me, but I'm just going to tell you the biggest mistake that I've made at Lessonly was I had the opportunity to hire an amazing product marketer 3 years ago, and I decided to put the budget somewhere else. Mm. And listen to me, everybody on here that is trying to scale a software company, hire product marketing. Do not wait. It will be so much harder to figure out go-to-market stuff by verticals, on segments, on business outcomes, business impact, customer stories, personas, if you do not hire product marketing. And we got smart recently, but it's the worst decision I've made as a marketing leader is to not hire that product marketer 3 years ago.
It boggles my mind a little bit that so many more companies don't share that opinion. It seems like the story goes, and the context here is I've talked to hundreds of companies about maybe even thousands of companies about their, growth strategies, go to market. It's something I talk about here with entrepreneurs on the podcast through customers. And it seems like the traditional journey is founding team, build something where, to solve an unmet need. They sell to the sort of innovators, early adopters, then they cross the chasm and they build a sales team, and then they forget to tell them all the cool stuff about the product and the customer and all the research. It's like they're two different companies that are like, we're not going to tell them that. We hired sales, we'll let sales figure it out. And like, I think if I was going to start again and I was building a software company, obviously it would go like, I'm non-technical. So it'd be non-technical buffoon, then a technical, a programmer, then a designer, then a product marketer, and then a marketer, and then a salesperson. I think that would be my stack of like, again, it would vary depending on what kind of tool I was building, but it's so critical to have that early because if you're
100%,
you can't have sales material without this product. And unless the founder is going to sit in that role,
sometimes the founders do, and that was the case at Lessonly early on, but we got to a scale where it was starting to really impact our go-to-market model because we didn't have somebody. And I can't, man, it is night and day difference when we brought on a product marketer. And it's this age old thing where it's like out of sight, out of mind until you have somebody focusing 100% of their time on it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it completely changes the way the business functions, you know? So if you're just take it from me, if you're close to 100 employees, hell, if you're close to 50 employees, you've found product market fit, you're chugging away to 10 million ARR and you don't have a product marketer, you need to halt. You need to get off this podcast and go hire one, because it is going to be very difficult for you in the future post 10 million to really scale it if you don't have somebody focused on that. And it's not product managers. They are not the same. And product marketing should live in the revenue org. Product marketing does not live in the product org, unless you're product led, which is a completely different, which we haven't talked about at all, because sales led is what it's our model.
Yeah. If you're curious about that, we did a podcast with David Cancel.
Great.
You can go check it out. It was like Aaron versus David, and I kind of got to moderate it. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It was great. Really appreciate you coming on the show. For those of us that are salespeople that are still hanging out, appreciate you hanging out. What is the distinction? Like, last question, just to add some clarity, because I totally agree. Amazing comment around product marketing being absolutely essential. What's the distinction between product manager and product marketing?
I see product marketing working more on the personas, win-loss reviews, competitive analysis, market analysis. Product management, and this is, there's going to be some people that are listening like, this guy's no idea what he's talking about, but product management to me is more getting deep on the reason you're building products for your customers, for your prospects. And I think that there's a little overlap there, but you can't have a person doing both. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what's important. You need to have somebody that's forward thinking, that's thinking about verticals, segments, use cases, personas. And then you have somebody thinking about the product who's also thinking about use cases and personas, but it's more product focused and they're on the product team. And those two people work together.
Beautiful. Well said. Like, I've sat in our product management role and I can absolutely agree. The goal of the product manager is to build product. It's not to build any of the marketing materials. And so the marketing is just a flip of that. It's the flip side. They're there to support the marketing team and essentially translate everything that the product team is doing so that salespeople can leverage all of that.
Absolutely.
Knowledge.
Absolutely.
Super valuable. Kyle, really loved having you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's fun.
If people are curious about the way that you're all doing things at Lessonly, or if they're curious about the platform, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
I share every day on LinkedIn and Twitter. So you can go type in Kyle Lacy on either and you'll find me.
Right on. Thanks again, Kyle.